If you would, turn to the Gospel of Mark. 2 weeks ago, we were talking about the pre-Christian New Testament. We're focusing on what people thought before Jesus came on the scene, which we can see during his childhood or even during his ministry. What did they think? And so that's what we were focusing on, and we focused on how to read the Gospels. And so we're going to go through Mark and Matthew and Luke and then in John, and then we'll be done with the Gospels, and we'll go in that order. So today we're going to start with Mark. The reason why we're going to start with Mark is most people think it is probably the earliest Gospel, so we'll go ahead and start with that. Some things about the Gospel of Mark. One, it focuses, I mean, there's lots of teaching, but there's more of a focus on action. If you compare, like for example, the book of Matthew to the book of Mark, Matthew has very long sections, the crowning of which is the Sermon on the Mount, of Jesus teaching. And of course, Jesus teaches in the Gospel of Mark. But there's more of a focus on what Jesus is doing and what's happening in his life, and less of a focus on the didactic part of his ministry. So that's one thing that's a little different about Mark. Now, one thing that's interesting, and this gets to how we view the Gospels potentially versus how the ancient world would have viewed the Gospels. Papias, who is one of the early church fathers, which we don't have any actual writings from anymore, though we do have quotations of his, he was, if I recall correctly, the disciple of John. Is that right? Do you guys remember that? So he was famous with the early church, and you can see quotations of him. And one quotation that he makes that I think is in Eusebius is he says that when Mark wrote, Mark was not actually trying to write in chronological order. Now, this is maybe unusual for us if we think about a biography or something like that. But here is an early church figure saying that wasn't Mark's goal. His goal was to write about the life of Jesus, but it was an evangelistic type document. He was writing down, in his words, in Papias' words, the reminiscences of Peter. Because Mark was not a disciple, but he was a relative of Peter's, and according to this tradition, Mark was writing down essentially what Peter had said. All right, so Mark, not an eyewitness, but Peter was. And so Mark was writing down Peter's eyewitness testimony based on Peter's preaching. So that's the general tradition. And so we might not want to take it as a strict chronological set of events. Now, in some sense, it is chronological. You know, his death and resurrection is last. So, in that sense, it is chronological. But at least in terms of his ministry and his life, maybe not. And if you look at the outline, roughly, it's the first 10 chapters are outside of Jerusalem, most of the time in Galilee, but sometimes in other places. Then he comes in Jerusalem, and then, of course, there is the Passion Week, which is all inside of Jerusalem. And so, you've got essentially one visit to Jerusalem in the book of Mark, where in, for example, the Gospel of John, you've got three. So don't take it as we've already said, this is not meant to be a detached history of the life of Jesus. This is absolutely an evangelistic document and should be read that way. One of the interesting things about the Gospel of Mark is there's a big focus on the early part of the book about the messianic secret. So you might know what I'm talking about when I say something like that. What's that?
How Jesus seems to not want people to know who he is or what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because he tells people, don't tell anybody this.
That's right. He'll do something and he'll say, okay, now, don't tell anyone. Of course, they will. They will go tell someone anyway. But Jesus tries to get them to not do that. It's a big feature in the early part of this gospel. The best explanation I've ever seen of this, which totally makes sense to me, is, you know, he's basically trying to stave off his death until the time actually comes when he is supposed to die. Because we know when he does get into the, whenever he gets in front of the Pharisees and the Sadducees in the trial, and they come at him, and he finally says, okay, I'm the Son of Man, and I'm going to come judge you. At that point, they say, done, we're going to kill him. So he has to avoid that at the beginning of the gospel, at the beginning of his ministry, to avoid these total confrontations with them, so that he can do his ministry, he can prepare his disciples. And then when the time comes, he can say, okay, let's have it. And then he's free. Freely talks about it. And so in general of an outline, that's basically how this works. He's outside, mostly in Galilee, but sometimes he goes into Gentile territory. When he goes and meets with the Syrophoenician woman, that's over, I think, in Tyre and Sidon. But mostly he's in Galilee, or then ultimately coming to Jerusalem and dying and rising from the dead. And so really, the last week of his life, as we mentioned a few times ago, are in 11 through 16. So in other words, a full third of this gospel is about the last week of his life. And of course, death and resurrection. That's clearly the focus here. That's where Mark is ultimately going. Now, a lot of people notice, and I don't know if this is true, but turn to Mark 8. A lot of people will say that specifically Mark, there's a spot in Mark 8 that you really see a shift. And this is really the shift where Jesus starts calling himself the Son of Man a lot. Okay? And of course, it's that self-identification as the Son of Man that will ultimately get him condemned by the Jewish council. But there's one mention where he calls himself the Son of Man before this point. But after this point, it comes up, I believe, five times. And so people will look essentially at this point where it is theologically clearly a tipping point where you've got chapter 8, verse 22, you've got Jesus healing a blind man, and then Jesus in 8:27, Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist," and others say, "Elijah," and others, "one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. And that's when he starts revealing the full picture, as you can see from the next verse. "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things to be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again." It makes sense. Maybe that is really a fulcrum or a high point in the Gospel of Mark. A lot of people will generally point to that. That is definitely the point where he starts using the phrase Son of Man a lot more. Now let's go look at the beginning. I want to focus on the beginning, the end, and then I want to go through the Gospel and talk about, you know, who's in and who's out, and then how Jesus is identified. So let's start at the very beginning. Sometimes the beginning of books can be very, very important. Mark chapter 1, verse 1. "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, 'Behold, I send my messenger before your face who will prepare your way, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight.'" First of all, in the beginning, it is a very legitimate question to ask, is this an allusion to Genesis 1? You've already got one other gospel that clearly makes an allusion to Genesis 1 at its very opening. "In the beginning was the Word." Right? John. Is that what he's doing here? It's actually entirely possible. Kind of hard to say. But that word beginning, arche, is exactly how Genesis begins in the Septuagint. In the beginning, just like John. So maybe, maybe not. Maybe he's just meaning to say at the beginning of his book. Now the word gospel at this point should not be considered a genre. We look at the gospels as essentially a unique set of books, a kind of a genre sort of all to itself within the New Testament. When Mark says this here, he's probably not thinking, "I'm starting a new genre right now." Okay, this is ultimately coming from Isaiah. He's thinking back to those prophecies, and he's saying, okay, this is the beginning of the good news, right? Gospel means good news. This is the beginning of the good news. What good news? That God is coming back to his people. And we can quite clearly see that this is tied in with Isaiah, because he quotes Isaiah just a little bit after. And so, probably not a genre. Just think of it in terms of not genre. Think of it as here's the good news pointing back to Isaiah. And of course, Jesus would do this in his ministry, saying, "I'm coming to preach the good news," and then would quote from Isaiah. This is something he did. This is something Mark is doing here. Now, one thing that all four of the gospel writers do, all right, and there's a lot of things they don't share, but one thing they all do is they all point to Isaiah 40 at very early in their gospel. And they say something about how John is the forerunner and that all of this that is happening in John and Jesus' ministry is ultimately bringing in what was going on in Isaiah 40. Now, in Mark's particular quotation, you actually have a mix of two verses. Not just Isaiah 40, but also Malachi. So turn to Malachi chapter 3. If we look, let's back up and go to chapter 2, verse 17. You have wearied Yahweh with your words, but you say, how have we wearied him? By saying, everyone who does evil is good in the sight of Yahweh, and he delights in them. Or by asking, where is the God of justice? In other words, why do you weary God? Because you doubt his justice. You doubt that he actually cares for the righteous. That's the critique here. Behold, here's God's promise. Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. That's the quote there. And whenever you see a quote from the Old Testament, always go look at the context in the Old Testament and see if it fits. And here, it totally fits. Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. Jesus did that. And the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says Yahweh of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming? And who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and a fuller's soap. He will sit as a refiner and a purifier of silver. He will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver. And they will bring offerings in righteousness to Yahweh. Then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to Yahweh as in the days of old and as in former years. Then I will draw near to you for judgment. I will be swift, a swift witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, against those who swear falsely, against those who press the hard worker in his wages, the widow and the fatherless, against those who thrust aside the sojourner, and do not fear me, says Yahweh of hosts. The day of the Lord, is it good news or bad news? Both, right? And that's exactly what happens in the gospel. Is the gospel good news? Generally speaking, yes. But Jesus coming to the temple is not good news for everybody, right? And we see that within the gospel as Jesus meets with people and says, yes, you're okay. You're not. You're okay, you're not. There's more of a focus on who is okay in the gospel, at least that seemed to me as I read through it. All right, so when he's quoting Malachi, he's talking about God coming back. And when you think of Isaiah, the focus of Isaiah chapter 40 is God coming back for blessing. That's the entire focus. Malachi, it's not. It's God's coming back, and it's for judgment, and bad things are about to happen. And so the combination of the two, here at the beginning of the book says Jesus is coming back. Jesus is here. This is the good news for some. You might remember a lot of the time when John has his discussion, what does he say? After me is coming someone whose sandals I am not worthy unto untie. And is he coming for blessing or judgment? He says it's both. He kind of focuses on the judgment side of things and says he's coming and he's going to refine everybody with fire. John's pointing back to the same idea. And so all the Gospels essentially have very early on this discussion of what's Jesus' role and what's he coming to do. It's totally good news for some and judgment ultimately for others. So that's the beginning of the book. And when we go through talking about who's in, who's out, we see perhaps a very different picture probably than most of the people at the time would assume. And we see that actually in the Gospels because people are like, wait a minute, why are you hanging out with them? And Jesus says, I came here to heal the sick, not the well. But we'll get to that here in a second. So that's the beginning. That's how it starts off. The ending is a little bit more difficult. And we won't spend a lot of time on this. I'm not sure it's a good choice. And we've done it before. So let's briefly talk about it, and then we'll jump more into the contents of the book. If you go to the last chapter, it's really a legitimate question where this gospel ends. As a general rule, it's typically fairly common for a lot of people or lay people to assume that this would end at verse 20, especially those who only read the King James. Most of the time when you get a translation, though, you'll get some sort of note saying that there's some problems here. Like, I'm looking at the ESV. Starting in verse 9, I've got these double brackets. And then those double brackets end at the very end of the book. As a general rule, among New Testament academics and whatnot, almost no one thinks it actually ends at 20 among that group. Most of them say one of two things. Either it ends at 8, and Mark meant for it to end at 8, or it ended after this point, and we just lost the ending, which, of course, is something that happened with ancient books. Now, if Mark was a scroll, that might be a little bit hard, because the end of a book, I believe, would be in the inside of a scroll and might be protected. If it was a book, well, you've probably had books where the covers would fall off, the back or the front, if it was actually that codex format. So, but who knows? It's a legitimate question, and really, no one knows the answer. For those who do say it really ends at 16:8, it's got kind of an enigmatic ending. It leaves some things unresolved, and essentially what they say is this is done for dramatic purposes, where ultimately you've got Jesus risen from the dead, and then you've got them here in fear, waiting to see what's going to happen next, and see, okay, they were afraid, but how are they going to live their life knowing that Jesus died but rose from the dead? What's going on? Leaving that as like a point of dramatic tension to tell the reader, hey, now what are you going to do? Because everybody knows the story after this. At least all the Christians would. When you read this in the church, they're going to know what happens next. This is and they were all afraid. Now how are you going to respond to this? I don't know. No one really knows for sure. That's the big debate in the book. Now let's start at the beginning.
Hey, Eric.
Yes, sir.
Just to make a point, that some of the strange practices that you see, I'll admit that I was pulled in and watched a series on, I think it was a National Geographic channel for a while, about snake handlers. But some of the weird Pentecostal, neo-Pentecostal practices that you see are solely based on this disputed passage in the Gospel of Mark, at the end of the Gospel of Mark. Yep. Verse 18.
Yeah, by and large, the verses aren't all that important, except for that, right? If you could tell some people, look, these things aren't actually a part of the Bible, then there's no reason to play with snakes in church, essentially, right? It's a good point.
I wonder why the earliest manuscripts didn't have these verses 9 through 20. Why were they added here now?
It's a good question. You got two things. You got to ask two questions. One, why would they be missing? And why would they be added? Would it be more likely for people in certain manuscripts to try to remove them? Or would it be more likely for people to, seeing that they're gone, put in another ending to resolve the tension?
Who did it?
Right. And it was early on, because the earliest manuscripts don't have it. And so, why don't the earliest manuscripts have it? And the way that, generally speaking, in terms of the reasons why most academics don't consider it valid, is one, it's more likely that people would try to deal with this whole tension of ending on, for they were afraid, which is a strange way to end a book, than it would be for people to actively try to remove part of the Bible. And also, just from a style and linguistic perspective, these last verses don't fit the rest of the Gospel of Mark. It's actually a quite consistent, if you're reading it in Greek, it's a nice, quite consistent language. And when you get here, there's lots of things that are very different. And so, those are some of the main reasons why people tend to say these things aren't authentic. I'm very convinced that they're not authentic, personally.
Early on, before the Passion, Jesus condemns anyone who looks for a sign. But then he said, in verse 17, he says, and these signs will accompany those who believe. Somebody really messed up, I think.
I think so.
Putting words in Jesus' mouth.
I think so. And you've got, like, for example, the condemnation in Revelation. Don't remove anything or add anything to this book. I agree.
Eric, I just want to re-inject a comment that we've said many times, but it's something that should be reiterated often, and that is the Christian New Testament is the most historically attested document in the ancient world. And these verses at the end of Mark that are disputed don't change any major doctrine at all of Christianity, other than we don't believe in snake handling. I wouldn't consider that a major doctrine. We're not going to ask Mike to prove your faith by playing with a copperhead. I mean, but there are fringe elements that would consider themselves Christian that do stuff like that. But
yep.
It did happen back in Paul's day. He grabbed it by his mate. It was a sign.
There's a big difference between it happened to Paul and God saved him, then, you know, you should do this. You should totally handle snakes just to prove that they won't hurt you.
And I told you about the series that I was watching. And there were two major preachers. One of them is dead now. So the series has been postponed. He got bit by a viper and killed him.
There you go. Yes, sir.
I think it's interesting that whole 17 through, I guess, 17 and 18, it's not only the snake handling, but the three other things are very, they're things that are prevalent in Pentecostal, the tongues, and driving out demons, and then you got Jesus saying that on the last day, many will say, come to him and say, didn't we drive out demons in your name?
Because
I didn't know you.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You're totally right.
Just thinking about textual criticism, there are some cases, I'm not saying this one, but there are some cases where they, even though there's an older manuscript that does or doesn't contain it, the evidence points to some that are not as old as that being the more valid. In our minds, we think, how could that have happened? We think, there's the text. They take this one to this city, they take this one to this city. And in this city, conditions are more favorable for the text to remain for a while. And copies start happening. And the older one actually gets corrupted very early on. And then later, when we look at it, we think, oh, that one's the right one because it's the older. But it's not necessarily the case. It could be the less reliable one, even though it's older. I'm not saying that about this passage.
Right.
But in general, you can't always say it's older, therefore, but that's the definitive text. It just depends on other conditions.
It does. And that's, you're totally right. You have to look at other things. And whenever people look at this, pretty much all the signs, right? They look at, there's external versus internal. They'll divide evidence in external and internal. External is manuscripts. It's how many manuscripts do we have that has such and such a thing? How old are they? How geographically diverse are they? There's this external evidences. Internal evidences would go to, does this fit with Mark? Given all the themes that he's talked about, is this thematically fit with Mark? Given the language of the book, is there a language shift in this? Does it make sense for him to write this? And so, yeah, there's absolutely sometimes reasons to outweigh the external evidence and go, for internal reasons, no, this is not the case. It can't be what that, or probably isn't what that older manuscript says. So yeah, that totally happens. In this particular case, there is no real debate that I've ever seen of people, unless they're really trying to hang on to the Textus Receptus or the King James Version for theological reasons. That's the only thing that I've really seen people try that really hold on to hold on to this, because externally and internally, all the evidence really points against it, I think. Which is why I'm totally convinced that it either ended at 8 or we're missing the ending, and I don't know the answer to that. Any other thoughts? Okay. Let's talk about who's in and who's out. We won't finish this today. We'll finish our discussion next week, but let's go ahead and get started. In terms of in, you've got various interactions between Jesus and people in the Gospels, all right? And it's interesting to look and see who he hangs out with, who he heals, who he teaches, and who he condemns. So let's talk about who's in. First of all, in chapter 1, verses 21 through 28, you've got him basically healing someone with an unclean spirit. You got verse 24. You've got the spirit. Spirit knows who he is. All right. What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. The demon knows who Jesus is. All right. Jesus heals the guy. Now, when we say who's in, what I don't mean is all of these people are in regardless. Often what this means is Jesus is going to people who you wouldn't think would become a part of the kingdom, and he's fixing them. And then, okay, they're okay once they have an encounter with Jesus. All right, so it's not just automatically in. Like, for example, if you were to think, who's a prime candidate? Who would be the greatest person to get to our church? A demon-possessed man might not be the first person you would go to, right? Jesus is different, though. Jesus has this interaction with this guy, and he fixes it, all right? He fixes the problem, casts out the demon. So even the demon-possessed, they can enter the kingdom of God. And then 29 through 34, right after this, it says that he was healing lots of people. So lots of people who needed help, who weren't the healthy, who weren't the whole, who were the demon-possessed, those are the people that Jesus was ministering to. Or in chapter 1, verse 40, where Jesus cleansed a leper. All right, what's the leper? Does the leper belong? No, the leper doesn't belong. He's unclean. He's supposed to stay out of the city. No, Jesus goes to the leper, and he heals the leper, and then he belongs again. Or about how about the paralytic in chapter 2? I mean, there's nothing necessarily wrong with him unless you assume maybe his parents sinned. You remember that discussion from the gospel. Then why is this guy suffering? Jesus heals the paralytic. Someone who's not whole, he can come in. Or chapter 2, verse 13. He, Jesus, went out beside the sea, and all the crowd was coming to him. And he was teaching them, and he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, "Follow me," and he rose and followed him. Nobody likes tax collectors.
Amen.
Right? Nobody likes tax collectors. Jesus told the tax collector, "Follow me," and he did, which means what? It means he's in, right? Because he followed Jesus. 3:31. All right? Are you special? Are you really in? Maybe if you're related to Jesus. And his mothers and brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and called him, and a crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, "Your mother and your brothers are outside seeking you." And he answered them, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And looking about at those who sat around him, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother." So who's in? It's not about family ties. It's about those who do the will of God. How about 5:24? We all know this story. And a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. And there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years. Other than the fact that she's sick, what's the problem?
Unclean.
She's unclean for 12 years. Okay? Certainly can't go into the temple in this state. And what does Jesus do? Well, she touches his garment and she gets healed. And then what does he say?
"Who touched me?"
Right? And so ultimately at the end of that, is she okay? Well, yeah, right? Through her encounter with Jesus, she who was stuck on the outside, unclean, all the time is now okay. Chapter 5. Same chapter. Actually, same event. So Jesus here talks with a guy named Jairus. Now, we shouldn't... So we think, what are the three groups of religious people in ancient Palestine? We got, you know, Pharisees, Sadducees, and according to Josephus, Essenes. We don't ever see them in the New Testament, but we know they're there, according to Josephus and others. Most Jews are not one of these people, right? It's not like us today, where most everybody who is in the kingdom, or at least pretends to be in the kingdom, goes to a church, and so they're Baptist or they're Methodist. They have someone to identify with. For most people during this time, they wouldn't actually identify with anybody in particular. They would just be Jews trying to follow the law. Now, the Pharisees, they were very popular, and people would look up to them as very pious. And the Sadducees, well, they would be like in charge of the temple. And so they would look up to them, but not everybody would be a Pharisee, and not everybody would be a Sadducee. Now, this guy here, Jairus, at least in the Gospel of Mark, is just identified as a leader of the synagogue. All right, and because he believes in Jesus, well, he's in. And of course, we've seen in some of the other Gospels that, well, sometimes when a Pharisee will come to Jesus and believe in Jesus, then they're in too. So synagogue rulers are in. Chapter 6. Chapter 6, verse 30. You've got a large crowd here, right? A large crowd wanting to listen to Jesus. And this is the scene of the Jesus feeds the 5,000. What's the lesson here? The whole crowd, the normal people out there, anyone who wants to go listen to Jesus, they're all in if they want to be. Anyone who wants to go and listen to Jesus' teaching. Or chapter 7. This is the one we mentioned earlier. The Syrophoenician woman. And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. This is 7:24. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. He's trying to do his ministry, but he's getting crowded. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to dogs." In other words, I'm here to help the Jews, not the Gentiles. And then she says, "Yes, Lord, but yet even the dogs, the Gentiles, under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying in the bed, and the demon gone. Who's in? Even the Gentiles are in. Who's out? Chapter 6, 14. Herod is clearly out. Not because he's an Edomite, but because he kills John. He persecutes the righteous. Herod is most definitely out. Chapter 7. You've got a confrontation between Jesus and the Pharisees and the scribes. And the main problem here is verse 6, "And he said to them, 'Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. You have the commandments of God and hold to the tradition of men.'" So they're holding their own ways and their old traditions before the commands of God. Those people are not in. Those people are out. Same chapter, verse 21. This is in discussion of defiling. All right, who's out? Well, from within, out of the heart of man come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. And these evil things come from within the person and they defile the person. So therefore, anyone who sins any of these sins are out. That's not what he means. Because, you know, if you think about the tax collector, the tax collector is totally going to be guilty of some of these things. But he was in. And a lot of the other people that would be in the crowds, they would be in this group too. What matters is those who leave these things, follow Jesus, they're all in. Those who continue to do these things, they're out. Those who follow God, in, no matter what they've done. Tax collectors, prostitutes, murderers, anything, they're in if they repent and follow. And then finally, and this is where we'll stop today, you've got the rich young man. The rich young man, very promising fellow. What's his problem? It's not that he's overtly wicked all the time. That's not his problem. He's infatuated with his money. He's not willing to ultimately give it all. And so is he in or is he out? Sounds like he's out. Verse 23 in chapter 10. And Jesus looked around and said to his disciples, "How difficult it will be for those who have wealth to enter the kingdom of God." Okay? That's what he means. This young man, this is going to be hard for him to get in because he's too infatuated with his money. Okay? So the Gospel of Mark, for them, would have been, you know, it really would have been very surprising, right? Who's in? Well, obviously the Pharisees are in. I mean, look how pious they are. They're great. That would be the assumption. If anybody's in, it's the Pharisees. Who's out? Well, obviously the tax collectors and the prostitutes and those and these sick and unclean people. Obviously, they're the ones who are out. And Jesus comes and he flips it, right? This is going back to the prophets, where the prophets are saying, look, you're neglecting the weakest, right? You're neglecting those who are having the most problems. When that's whom God wants you to care for. Classic example, orphans and the widows. Okay? Those who can't protect themselves, they're not your best choices for tithes and servants. They're not. But you don't neglect them because God wants to help them, right? That was the critique in the Old Testament. Jesus continues the critique here. None of these people belong. They're not your classic, hey man, these are the best people. But that's who Jesus came to save, because Jesus came to save those who were sick, not those who at least thought they were well. Okay, so next time we will go through some of the ways that Mark identifies Jesus, because he goes through and says a lot of interesting things about Jesus throughout the gospel. So we'll go through that next time, because we are out of time now. Any final thoughts or questions on what we discussed? Yes?
The Sadducees and Pharisees were wealthy.
I don't know. I've heard that from some of my reading makes me think that the Sadducees are more of like the landed wealthy class. But I don't know for sure. Yeah.
You're staying back and look at all these incidences of healing, and none of them have been able to follow Jesus on their own.
Mm-hmm.
It's really talking about total inability. They were either blind and couldn't see him, they were crippled and couldn't follow him, they were unclean so they couldn't be in his presence, and until Jesus healed them, they would never have been able to do anything to follow him. Matthew yeah. would continue to be a tax collector, but Jesus hadn't called him.
Yeah.
And ultimately Lazarus would still be in the tomb. Jesus hadn't called him out.
Yeah.
So there was a didactic purpose to everything he did.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What was the evidence that Mark and Peter might be related?
What's that?
You say Mark and Peter might be related?
So the evidence is all essentially from tradition. And so I'll get the actual quote for you guys next time, the one from Papias. But essentially from early church tradition, including Papias, the idea is Mark was with Peter and heard Peter's preaching and then wrote it down. And so essentially the gospel is from the preaching ministry of Peter, the gospel of Mark. Right, he was with Barnabas, but he was, I think he's cousins with Peter, or nephew of Peter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is the John Mark who shows up at the end of some of Paul's letters, and the John Mark that's in Acts. At least according to church tradition, it ties all of them together. From this gospel, just the writing itself, you can't tie this to John Mark, that same guy. But the church tradition says, yes, that guy is this guy, is writing down what Peter said. So it is, it's eyewitness testimony in the same sense that Luke's is eyewitness testimony. Luke was not there, but Luke was gathering lots of sources. According to the tradition, Mark was not gathering lots of sources. Mark had one main source, Peter.
I read this morning that Mark was the first Coptic pope, 51 in Alexandria,
yeah.
Egypt, and of course they got bombed.
Yeah, that's the tradition. So first Coptic pope. That's okay. That's totally anachronistic. What's funny? Why that's anachronistic? Does anybody know why he can't be a Coptic pope? What's that?
Do they not have popes?
The Coptic language wasn't really a thing until a little bit later. Like you don't get the Coptic language until like the 3rd or 4th century. A.D., because Coptic language is essentially Egyptian mixed with Greek, which would totally happen in Alexandria. But they do say that. Yeah, he was ministering in Alexandria, Egypt. Yeah. I mean, everybody wants, they all want a pope. They want to be able to go back and say, "I Baptists don't care." Other than the Baptists, everybody wants to say, "No, we got a guy. He was in this city in the first century." It's a reasonable thing to hope for, I guess. But
his bones are in Venice, too. If you
want to
pay money to see him. I didn't
have money. Man, that guy's everywhere.
St. Mark's Church.
I went up, but I didn't pay the money to go to the...
We didn't pay either.
I just looked. You can kind of look over there. You have to, if you want to go in and see everything, you have to pay.
You
got to
pay money?
Yeah, I did that, but I didn't.
No, I just kind of was like,
I took a picture.
I saw a lot of dead people. I saw a lot of dead people. They have lots of like little shrines to put like wax popes. It looks like they look like they're wax. It's really creepy, but you can go look at the dead people.
If you go to Eastern Orthodox monasteries, you'll see collections of skulls. They'll keep them. For their saints, they'll keep them. They have a different theology than we do. They do.